Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Fatima Meknes's feet sink into the golden sand as she looks at the last beach in Morocco's north. One can almost see a sense of hopefulness in her eyes. Meknes has finally realized her dream of working on a fishing boat in the Mediterranean. Behind her, the members of Morocco's first female fishing cooperative push a small boat toward the water. It is time to go fishing. The women jump in the boat and start on the first government-recognized female fishing trip. After 2 years of training, they have broken through the barriers of a male-dominated field. We live in the sea, and if we separate from it, we will die like fish, Meknes told the Associated Press. The sea is my entire life and that of my children and the people of the village. Meknes is president of the fishing cooperative in Belyounek, a village at the bottom of Mount Moses. The village is cut off from the world except for a side facing the sea. Belyounek overlooks the Spanish town of Ceuta, 7 kilometers to the east. The closing of the Ceuta border in the early 2000s hurt the local economy. Village men who had worked in Ceuta were forced to fall back on traditions of their ancestors. They began pulling octopus, squid, and red tuna from the waters to feed their families and sell in nearby towns. Women returned to doing domestic work. I was a house cleaner and a nanny in Ceuta, said 60-year-old Kadouj Gazil. I worked for families for 20 euros a day and made a comfortable living. But when the border was closed, I just stayed home for years and years, watching the sea from my window. Then she and other women began repairing fishing equipment and cleaning boats, but without pay. Women have few paying jobs in the independent fishing business. One reason was lack of training. The industry provides 170,000 direct jobs, and the money earned helps 5.2 million Moroccans, says Tommy Mekdi of the National Maritime Popularization Center in La Roche. For 2 years, we've been giving women all the necessary training so they can fish safely and professionally and know how to keep themselves from harm's way, Mekdi said. Of the 19 women in the Belyounek cooperative, only 4 earned money from fishing in the past. Men didn't like the fact that a woman is at sea fishing, said Fatia Naji, who was forced to become a fisher after her husband lost his job when the border closed. She faced insults for working. She said, I would often think, what if other women in the village were with me? The cooperative was launched in March 2018 to help the women enter the market. At first, they repaired equipment, although this time for money. Then the women began to set their eyes on the sea. Meknes said, working in the sea is not easy, but it is what my sisters and I love. It is finally coming true.
As the coronavirus continues to spread among humans around the world, conservationists are warning of its possible risk to another group, Africa's endangered mountain gorillas. Congo's Virunga National Park is home to about 30% of the world's mountain gorillas. The park is barring visitors until June 1st, because scientists believe the gorillas may be able to catch the new coronavirus. Neighboring Rwanda also is shutting down visitor and research activities in three national parks that are home to gorillas and chimpanzees. Mountain gorillas can contract some respiratory diseases that humans contract. A simple cold can kill a gorilla, says the Worldwide Fund for Nature. That is why park visitors are not supposed to get too close to gorillas. Rules call for a 7-meter distance between gorillas and humans. About 1,000 mountain gorillas live in protected areas in Congo, Uganda, and Rwanda. Permitting the public to visit these areas is important and profitable. However, COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, led Virunga Park officials to order the temporary ban. Conservationists have welcomed the decision. Paula Kahumba leads the Kenya-based conservation group Wildlife Direct. She says that every possible effort must be made to protect mountain gorillas because so few are left in the wild. We know that gorillas are very sensitive to human diseases, Kahumba said. If anyone has a cold or a flu, they are not allowed to go and see the gorillas. She added that people can spread the new coronavirus before they show any signs of infection. So, visitors could put those gorillas at risk. Even under normal conditions, park measures to protect the gorillas from tourists may not be enough. Gladys Kalema Zikusoka is the founder and leader of the Uganda-based Conservation Through Public Health. She noted a study done this year by her organization and Ohio University. It looked at Bwindi Impenetrable National Park. She said the research showed that the rule separating gorillas and tourists was ineffective. Kalema Zikusoka said the study showed that the 7-meter rule was violated almost every time a group of visitors entered the park. She said visitors were to blame about 60% of the time. In the other cases, it was the gorillas that moved too close to the humans. Uganda has not announced a shutdown of gorilla park tourism. However, the number of visitors from Europe and other places has sharply decreased. The mountain gorilla population shrank severely in the past 100 years because of disease and hunting, which is illegal. Mountain gorillas have been listed as endangered since 1996, but their population is now growing. Tourism brings much foreign money into Rwanda and Uganda. Tourism earnings are important in efforts to protect mountain gorillas. Officials can use it to help local communities or invest in anti-hunting operations. A gorilla tracking permit costs up to $600 in Uganda. A similar permit costs more than $1,000 in Rwanda. Some observers worry a decrease in tourism during the coronavirus crisis could endanger gorillas. Hunters might become more active if they think the crisis has weakened security.
Scientists have studied an ancient fish that they say shows the early origins of the bone structures found in the human hand. The discovery was made by researchers who examined a nearly complete fossil of a fish that lived about 380 million years ago. The fish, called Elpistostega watsoni, is believed to have lived in waters in what is now eastern Canada. The researchers say their findings provide new information about the way fish began to develop into vertebrates that could survive on land. The team of scientists from Australia and Canada reported their research in a study published in Nature. Inside the top of Elpistostega's front fins, called pectoral fins, were small bones appearing in several separate digits, an early form of fingers. These digits would have given the fish's fin the strength to hold its weight and to move on land. Richard Cloutier of Canada's University of Quebec in Rimouski is a paleontologist who helped lead the research. He told Reuters news agency the discovery shows clear links between the development of Elpistostega and human evolution. By looking at Elpistostega, it is important to realize that we, as human beings, are coming from a long line of evolution, that every part of our body, like our fingers, has a long evolutionary history, Cloutier said. He added that such development was not only important for Homo sapiens, the species of human that exists today, but for all living organisms. The four-legged land animals that evolved from fish like Elpistostega are called tetrapods, a group that covers amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals, including humans. The digits of the thousands of living species of tetrapods all share the same basic structures that scientists found in Elpistostega. The researchers used computerized image technology to examine the 1.6-meter-long fossil. The results showed upper and lower parts of a complete pectoral fin for the first time in any Elpistostega fish, the team reported. The process also showed the formation of wrist bones and divided digits. The digits were still contained within the fin, however, so they could not move independently like fingers, the researchers said. Elpistostega's body was similar to a crocodile, and the animal lived mainly in water. It had a flat head with eyes at the top and many teeth around the jaw area. Its body was thin, with well-developed fins. It is unclear whether Elpistostega sometimes moved on land, but the structure of its fins would have made this possible, said study co-writer John Long of Flinders University in Adelaide, Australia. This finding pushes back the origin of digits in vertebrates to the fish level, Long said in a statement, and tells us that the patterning for the vertebrate hand was first developed deep in evolution, just before fishes left the water. Elpistostega was known only from fossil parts until the complete set of bones was found in Canada's Miguasha National Park in 2010. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell about the Korean War. The biggest problem facing Dwight Eisenhower when he became President of the United States was the continuing conflict in Korea. Eisenhower was elected in November 1952. At the time, the United States had been helping South Korea fight North Korea for more than 2 years. About 20 other members of the United Nations were also helping the South. The UN members provided troops, equipment, and medical aid.
I shall go to Korea.
During the American presidential election campaign, Eisenhower announced that he would go to Korea. He thought such a trip would help end the war. Eisenhower kept his promise. He went to Korea after he won the election, but before he was sworn in as president. Yet the fighting did not stop in Korea until July of the next year, 1953. The war started when North Korean troops invaded South Korea. Both sides believed they should control all of the country. The dream of a united Korea was a powerful one. From 1910 until World War II, Korea had been under Japanese rule. In an agreement at the end of the war, troops from the Soviet Union occupied the North. They accepted the surrender of Japanese troops and set up a military government. American troops did the same in the South. The border dividing North and South was the geographic line known as the 38th parallel. A few years later, the United Nations General Assembly ordered free elections for all of Korea. With UN help, the South established the Republic of Korea. Syngman Rhee was elected the first president. On the other side of the 38th parallel, however, Soviet troops refused to let UN election officials enter the North. The Soviet Union supported the creation of a communist government there called the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Kim Il-sung was named premier. Five years after the end of World War II, the United States had withdrawn almost all of its troops from South Korea. It was not clear if America would defend the South from attack. South Korea had an army, but it was smaller and less powerful than the North Korean army. North Korea decided the time was right to invade. On June 25, 1950, North Korean soldiers crossed the 38th parallel. The UN Security Council demanded that they go back. 2 days later, the council approved military support for South Korea. The Soviet delegate boycotted the meeting that day. If he had been present, the resolution would have been defeated. The UN demand did not stop the North Korean troops. They continued to push south. In a week, they were at the edge of the capital, Seoul. Harry Truman, America's president at that time, ordered air and sea support for South Korea. A few days later, he announced that American ground forces would also be sent. Truman wanted an American to command UN troops in Korea. The UN approved his choice, General Douglas MacArthur. Week after week, more UN forces arrived in the south. Yet by August, they had been pushed back to the Pusan perimeter. This was a battle line around an area near the city of Pusan in the southeast corner of Korea. North Korean forces attempted to break through the Pusan perimeter. They began a major attack on August 6th. They lost many men, however, and by the end of the month, they withdrew. The next month, General MacArthur directed a surprise landing of American Marines in South Korea. They arrived at the port of Incheon on the northwest coast. The landing was extremely dangerous. Water levels could rise or fall as much as 9 meters in a single day. The boats had to get close to the coastline and land at high tide. If they waited too long, the water level would drop and they would be trapped in the mud with little protection. The soldiers on the boats would be easy targets. The landing at Incheon was successful. The additional troops quickly divided the North Korean forces, which had been stretched from north to south. At the same time, UN air and sea power destroyed the Northern Army's lines of communication. On October 1st, South Korean troops entered North Korea. They captured the capital, Pyongyang. Then they moved toward the Yalu River, the border between North Korea and China. China warned against moving closer to the border. General MacArthur ordered the troops to continue their attacks. He repeatedly said he did not believe that China would enter the war in force. MacArthur was wrong. Several hundred thousand Chinese soldiers crossed into North Korea in October and November. Still, MacArthur thought the war would end by December 25th, the Christmas holiday. This was not to happen. The UN troops were forced to withdraw from Pyongyang. And by the day before Christmas, there had been a huge withdrawal by sea from the coastal city of Hongnam. In the first days of 1951, the North Koreans recaptured Seoul. The UN troops withdrew about 40 kilometers south of the city. They reorganized and 2 months later regained control of Seoul. Then the war changed. The two sides began fighting in an area north of the 38th parallel. They exchanged control of the same territory over and over again. Men were dying, but no one was winning. The cost in lives was huge. General MacArthur had wanted to enter China and attack Manchuria. He also had wanted to use nationalist Chinese troops against the communists. President Truman feared that these actions might start another world war.
If we do have another world war, it will be an atomic war. We could expect many atomic bombs to be dropped on American cities. and a single one of them could cause many more times the casualties than we have suffered in all the fighting in Korea. I do not want to be responsible for bringing that about.
When MacArthur disagreed in public with the president's policies on Korea, including the general's statement, "There is no substitute for victory," Truman dismissed MacArthur.
"It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders, but the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual."
In June 1951, the Soviet delegate to the United Nations proposed a ceasefire for Korea. Peace talks began, first at Kaesong, then at Panmunjom. By November, hope for a settlement was strong. But negotiators could not agree about several issues, including the return of prisoners. The UN demanded that prisoners of war be permitted to choose if they wanted to go home. The different issues could not be settled after more than a year. Finally, in November 1952, the peace talks were suspended. Fighting continued during the negotiations. As it did, President Truman lost support. This was one reason why he decided not to seek re-election. The new president, Dwight Eisenhower, took office in January 1953. Eisenhower had campaigned to end the war. He was willing to take strong action to do this. Years later, he wrote that he secretly threatened to expand the war and use nuclear weapons if the Soviets did not help restart the peace talks. Such measures were not necessary. In a few months, North Korea accepted an earlier UN offer to trade prisoners who were sick or wounded. The two sides finally signed an armistice agreement on July 27, 1953. The agreement stopped the fighting and provided for the exchange of about 90,000 prisoners of war. It also permitted prisoners to choose if they wanted to go home. The war in Korea damaged almost all of the country. As many as 2 million people may have died, including many civilians. After the war, the United States provided hundreds of thousands of soldiers to help the South guard against attack from the North. Half a century has passed since the truce, yet Korea is still divided, and many of the same issues still threaten the Korean people and the world. The Korean conflict increased efforts in the United States to develop a weapon more deadly than the atomic bombs that had been used against Japan to end World War II. These efforts led to the hydrogen bomb. The Soviets were developing such a weapon too. They had already developed and tested an atomic bomb. The 1950s found Americans at home feeling hopeful about the economic future while also living under the threat of nuclear war.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.